The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. We are so glad you're here. Today's podcast, we have kind of some reflective thoughts on Monica Lewinsky. She's doing this big, you know, Clinton scandal docuseries that is premiering this weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel it, in listening to her, I find her fascinating. And it's made me kind of examine everything I thought I knew about that, but not in the way, not politically at all. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
We have Catherine Harris on as well. She was the Secretary of State during the 2000 recount in Florida. There's another recount going on in Florida. We're going to find out what's going on with it and what is the truth in the media, because we're not hearing it right now.
A little bit of wisdom from Rabbi Daniel Lappin and a little bit of fun from Andrew Heaton.
By the way, you can enter the contest right now. Mercury One has the thing going on right now where you can buy a $100 raffle ticket and maybe win a Mercedes, which is really cool.
But you also, if you do it for the next until midnight on Thursday, we're going to draw another name, and maybe it's you, and we're going to invite you to come on down. We'll pay for the airfare and the hotel and everything to be part of our big Black History Month temporary museum exhibit that is happening here at our studios. And so you'll come in on a Friday and spend the weekend, and it's a lot of fun. It's called 12 Score and 3 Years Ago. That is happening in February. I'm going to call somebody tomorrow. Might as well be you. And draw out a name and bring him down for a weekend here in Dallas in February. So go to mercury1.org/M1ball, mercury1.org/M1ball, and help us help other people all around the world by buying a lottery ticket. And you have to do that before midnight tonight. That is Thursday.
Do that and listen to this.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. It's Thursday, November 15th.
We're thrilled to have Home Title Lock on with us. Home Title Lock is something that Stu turned me on to, and you have to have this not only for yourself, but you might also recommend, if I may, checking your parents' homes or your, you know, aunt or whoever might be elderly now, because this is the FBI says fastest growing crime.
Especially because, you know, if they bought a house and they've lived in the same house for a long period of time, this is a big target for these home title fraud people, because they know there's a lot of equity there. It's probably paid off. You can take out large home equity loans, and they get to keep the money, and you have to pay for it. It's a disaster. You don't want to deal with it. So do what both of us have now done now. Go to Home Title Lock. For pennies a day, they put a barrier around your home's title and mortgage. They'll take care of this. They make sure you're protected. Get your $100 search free with sign up at HomeTitleLock.com. It's HomeTitleLock.com. You should go there now. Get it out of the way. HomeTitleLock.com.
Glenn Beck.
Okay, you know, out of all the presidential candidates that could run for president in 2020 for the Democrats, I'm just thinking that Avenatti is, you know, I think he's probably, you might want to take him off the list, Democrats. You might want to. Now, I'm all for him. In fact, I'm printing up T-shirts for him. He's the creepy porn lawyer. He's the guy that has been representing not only Stormy Daniels, but also, you know, the worst of the worst in the Kavanaugh hearings. Okay, that's this guy. He was arrested yesterday afternoon in Los Angeles, and the reason why he was arrested kind of makes you think that maybe there's some kind of invisible force out there making sure, you know, either irony or maybe even karma is receiving its daily offering. I'm just saying. Michael Avenatti was arrested for domestic violence. Now, the alleged victim filed the complaint on Wednesday, but the incident began on Tuesday. The woman involved is said to have bruising and swelling on her face and was kicked out of Avenatti's Los Angeles area apartment. Avenatti was heard screaming, "This is BS. This is effing BS. She hit me first." Oh, well, if she hit you first, Yeah, I don't think the whole "she hit me first" line is going to be a good strategy used in court. You might want to rethink that one. Oh, he already has. Now, I don't know if the media, specifically CNN and MSNBC, are going to do any mea culpas over the next 12 to 24 hours, but I highly doubt it. They have become the Avenatti network and the PR wing over the last 8 months. In fact, from March to May, the two networks had Avenatti on over 100 times. He gave 147 interviews on both cable and network TV. MSNBC host Lawrence O'Donnell actually said, quote, "Michael Avenatti is becoming my co-host, I have to say." Now, this is, you know, this is before he dragged Julie Swetnick into the limelight to attack Kavanaugh. You know, I wonder, is this going to teach the networks? Nah, let's not spend any time even thinking about that. Could be a learning moment, but it won't be. Speaking of Kavanaugh, you have to hear this Twitter exchange between one user and Avenatti on October 5th that said, "Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed, and it's Michael Avenatti's fault, seriously." That's when Avenatti replied, quote, "You are right. I should have turned my back on my client, told her to shut up and stay quiet because people like you apparently believe assault victims are to blame." Oh, this line of thinking is disgusting and offensive to all survivors. Yeah. And let's all remember, she hit him first. Then there's this today. Here is his statement that he made last night.
"I have never struck a woman. I never will strike a woman. Mm-hmm. I have been an advocate for women's rights my entire career, and I'm going to continue to be an advocate. I am not going to be intimidated from stopping what I am doing. I am a father to two beautiful, smart daughters. I would never disrespect them by touching a woman inappropriately or striking a woman."
Wow.
"I am looking forward to a full investigation, at which point I am confident that I will be fully exonerated."
This is a white man. Okay, this is a white man saying this. This is the oppressor saying this. And in the court of Avenatti, you know, in the hashtag Me Too in public opinion nowadays, that court, you know, holding him to the standard that he helped create, is this statement that he just made not, quote, disgusting and offensive to all survivors? Are we not supposed to believe the woman? Are we not supposed to immediately deem him guilty as accused, run him out of the public square, make sure that he never has a job again, that he could never, ever have a good name or even a chance to defend himself? I wonder if all the men and women screaming at Kavanaugh and the GOP senators in elevators can now see the Pandora's box that they actually wanted open. Did he hit this woman? Well, witnesses say he said, "This is BS, this is BS, she hit me first." Now he's on the record saying, "I didn't hit her." Is it possible this woman just made this up? Yes. Yes, it is. Is it possible that he hit her? Yes. Yes, it is. Should we judge him and condemn him and burn him at the stake? Oh, my gosh. My hands are shaking as I try to keep the match in the box. But we wait, and he is innocent until he is found guilty. We have to presume that he is innocent until all of the evidence comes out proving that he's not. By the way, I'm not telling you anything new. You know this. I'm just making sure the record is very, very clear on where constitutionalists stand, where Americans stand. I want the media to hear it very, very clearly. Avenatti is not guilty. We're not saying that he is a spouse abuser, a girlfriend abuser, that he advocates violence against women. We're not saying any of that. Now, I am saying that he's a scumbag, I am saying that he's really, really shady, but that doesn't mean he beats women. See, this is how it works. And when no one else will lead, I guess we will lead. You and I will lead. We're going to do, set the example, do something extraordinary here, something radical. Let's wait for all of the evidence. We're going to wait for all of the evidence to come out before we convict someone of a crime. That doesn't mean that we don't roll our eyes, we don't laugh, we don't say, wow, there is a God. There is such a thing as karma. Doesn't mean we don't say that and kind of revel in it a little bit. But as far as destroying a man's life on this, no, I don't think so. Avenatti, even the worst, get due process that he deserves. But I doubt neither he nor anyone screaming for Kavanaugh's head will realize exactly what's just happened.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Well, it's been a busy week for the former first ladies, for current first lady Melania Trump, but it has also been a busy one for the woman who 20 odd years ago, while working at the White House for then the then president at the age of 21, shot to fame in the most embarrassing way possible. The name, of course, we all know. In fact, her last name has become a verb, Monica Lewinsky. She has released the, quote, Clinton Affair docuseries that premieres this weekend on A&E. It's a 6-part series examining the cringe-inducing days and months surrounding her affair with Bill Clinton. In an article in Vanity Fair earlier this year, she wrote this: some closest to me asked why I would want to revisit the most painful and traumatic parts of my life, again, publicly, on camera, with no control on how it would be used. A bit of a head-scratcher, as my brother is fond of saying, do I wish I could erase my years in D.C. from my memory, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind style. Well, is the sky blue? I can't. And in order to move forward in life, I must take risks, both professional and emotional. An important part of my moving forward is excavating, and often painfully, what has gone before. When politicians are asked uncomfortable questions, they often duck and dodge by saying, that's old news, it's from the past. Yes, but that's exactly where we need to start to heal, with the past, but it isn't easy. She added, filming the documentary forced me to acknowledge to myself past behavior that I still regret and feel ashamed of. I think this is a really good thing. There are many, many, many moments when I question not just the decision to participate, but my sanity itself. Despite all the ways I tried to protect my mental health, it was still challenging. During one therapy session, I told my therapist I was feeling especially depressed. She suggested that sometimes what we experience as depression is actually grief. Yes, it was grief. The process of this docuseries led me to new rooms of shame that I still need to explore. Meanwhile, Bill Clinton, the man who has been accused of all sorts of terrible, terrible things, a close friend of Harvey Weinstein, recently admitted that he didn't feel the need to apologize to Lewinsky. Lewinsky disagrees. I'm less disappointed by him and more disappointed for him. He would have been a better man for it, and we in turn a better society. The hashtag MeToo movement has been a wrecking ball for so many men. Yet Bill Clinton, perhaps the most prolific of them all, has escaped unscathed, but perhaps that begins to change with this docuseries. Stu, I don't know how we're supposed to feel. I don't know what the politically correct thing is to feel. But the more I see Monica Lewinsky, the more I like her. And the more empathy I have for her. Who didn't make stupid moves when they were 21? Can you imagine, whatever it is, the worst thing you've ever done in your life, if that was all you were known for,
yeah,
and it would never go away, and you couldn't have, I mean, how does she have a regular relationship? I mean, as a guy, you're married to Monica Lewinsky. How many jokes if you're dating her? So, how many jokes?
Yeah, that would be agonizing.
It would be horrible.
Yeah, and you know what? I think one of the reasons why she comes off as likable is she seems to be the only one in that entire situation who's actually wrestled with what occurred. Right? Like, Bill Clinton has never shown any true understanding of what happened there. Hillary Clinton has never wrestled with what happened, I think, from her perspective, when she was basically trying to, you know, beat these women into oblivion politically to make them go away, to preserve her husband's career. She really seems to have done soul searching. And what I like about it is she's not just coming out and saying, I'm a victim and look at me. I'm the new face of Me Too. Right. Like, she's saying, I did some things, you know, really terrible things, and I shouldn't have done them, and I feel terrible about them, and I have called and written people that I wronged at the time to apologize, and I think she seems to really have a good
perspective. I think she's a remarkable woman. Let's play a couple of clips from this. Just play clip number one here, Sarah.
There was a point for me somewhere in this sort of first several hours where I would be hysterically crying, and then I would just shut down. And in the shutdown period, I remember looking out the window and thinking that the only way to fix this was to kill myself, was to jump out the window. Mm. And I felt terrible. I was scared, and I was mortified and afraid of what this was going to do to my family. And, you know, I still was in love with Bill at the time. So I felt really responsible.
I mean, that's...
Wow.
She felt responsible for giving him problems, right? She was so in love with him. That she felt, and she said this in another point too, that she didn't come out and speak out about it initially because she
didn't want to cause problems.
She was okay with him denying the affair initially because she didn't want to cause problems for him. That's a tough. I mean, look, again, she admits that she did wrong here. He was worse. Obviously, he was the one that's required to not do things like that. I mean, you know, she did something wrong though too, and she admits that. But I mean, that is a brutal moment, you know, and you can imagine it's nonstop for her. The entire country is talking about her. You know, Bill Clinton's the president of the United States. He's used to this sort of stuff. He has a capacity to deal with it at some level. You're just some intern who rolls in there and gets out of control and does something stupid. And then your entire life is defined by it. That is really, I mean,
I want you to, could I play that clip one more time, but I want you to listen to it with a different ear. 'Cause this is what struck me. This was happening when we were doing morning radio. Were you with me at that time? Probably not.
I was there. Yeah, and then we did. Yeah, you know, we did the trial. We did a whole show
based on the trial.
Yeah.
And I can't recall, but I'm sure I made Lewinsky jokes.
Oh, I'm sure we did. Everybody in America was making them.
Everybody.
At the time.
I want you to just put yourself right now, real quick, back in that time of what you were doing and saying at the time. And now, listen to what she was going through at the same time we were doing whatever it is we were all engaged in. Listen one more time.
There was a point for me somewhere in this sort of first several hours where I would be hysterically crying and then I would just shut down. And in the shutdown period, I remember looking out the window and thinking that the only way to fix this was to kill myself, was to jump out the window. And I felt terrible. I was scared, and I was mortified and afraid of what this was going to do to my family. And, you know, I still was in love with Bill at the time. So I felt really responsible. Hmm.
As we were just arguing about, he lied, he's a dirtbag, he shouldn't be president, she was worried about her family. She was contemplating suicide because she just wanted it to stop. How many of us took the time or were Christ-like enough to be able to say, she's a human being. Wait a minute. Hang on just a second. This is a human being. This isn't about politics when it comes to her. Think of how she was run through the mud. And nobody really cared about her. I don't think anybody really cared about her. It was all about him. Nobody really cared about her.
Yeah, you know, interesting. She never really was an ally of the right. Where, you know, sometimes where you have like, you know, if someone accused Barack Obama of an affair and was outward and speaking about it, like Stormy Daniels is with Trump, right?
Yes,
like
yes.
Stormy Daniels feels, I'm sure, to the left like an ally because she's trying to take the president down. Monica Lewinsky never was like that. You remember, it was Linda Tripp who recorded her. It was the whole reason why a lot of this stuff came out. She didn't go to the, she didn't try to destroy his career with this information.
No,
at
she
any point.
Just knew. She talked to Linda Tripp, if I'm not mistaken, because she knew she was in trouble.
Some of the other accusers were more outspoken.
Right.
I mean, you know, Paula Jones and those who became figures that were at least accepted by half the country. Monica Lewinsky, because she never really aligned herself with the right in the effort to take Clinton down, she had no allies because, of course, the Democrats abandoned her immediately. And, you know, she became just the butt of jokes. I don't know that I ever realized it. It's a really interesting way you put that, to listen to it with that ear, because I don't know that I ever realized it with that case. And that case was a long time ago. But we were, I'm sure, making jokes and stuff like everybody was.
I know we were. It had to have been. Everybody was.
John Ronson was a guy, and we've had him on a few times, who wrote a book about more in the social media era. These people, these random stories you hear that bubble up for one day. But, you know, the woman, the famous, most famous one is the woman who made the joke about AIDS in Africa, trying to mock the fact that we didn't care about Africa enough.
But she was going over to Africa on a plane to go help.
She was going over to help, and she was on the plane when the tweet blew up, went viral, and her life was basically ruined. And you read stories like that, and you realize when this thing that seems fun to give snarky comments to on the web, there's somebody there just suffering through that moment. It's the worst moment of their lives. I know you've done this with several of these situations. The one that pops into my head was James Gunn, the guy who did Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
And they unearthed some tweets of his that were not ones he wanted to represent his current character. And he lost that gig. We're talking, you know, this is an 8-figure gig for him. And you were on Twitter saying, like, look, I understand, and I think a lot of people on the right did go after him for that because he was a left-wing celebrity and he was critical of people like Ben Shapiro. But I mean, in those moments, if you can kind of get over that desire to feel that emotion, I think you wind up being a better person for it.
I think you do. And this brings me to something else. Monica Lewinsky now, that's all she is. It's like Brett Kavanaugh. That's all he'll be.
Yeah.
He'll be that moment. Doesn't matter how long he lives for the rest of his life. Clarence Thomas, pubic hair. That's all he is. He will always have that attached. There's something that's happening in Europe, and I find it viscerally the right thing, but intellectually, absolutely the wrong thing. They're now in Europe, they are claiming there is another human right that all humans deserve, and that is the right to be forgotten. Now think of this. Monica Lewinsky, the case would be she has a right to be forgotten. She shouldn't have to live her entire life apologizing or being shaped by one event in her life when she was 21 years old. She has a right to be forgotten. And because of the internet, it never goes away. It's always there. And so you don't have a chance to start over again. And I really do believe this is something that we have to address, because our memories, they work to our advantage. I mean, our memories soften. We think of our childhood years as better years, most of us, even though they weren't. They weren't. We just see them differently. Time eases things. But when you have the internet and it is right there in your face and it's always that thing, you don't ever move. If you're big enough, if that mistake was big enough, like Monica Lewinsky, she can never move on from that. Now, they're passing laws in Europe, but the problem with it is, well, then are you erasing history? You can't erase history. But how do we balance this? How do we balance the right to be forgotten with the right to record history as it really truly was? We have no separation from the history now, and that's the real problem. This is the best of the Glenn Beck program, and we really want to thank you for listening. Kind of like deja vu, as we look at a Florida recount, and I welcome to the program Catherine Harris, a former Florida Secretary of State who oversaw the nonsense that was happening in Florida in 2000. Catherine, how are you?
I'm so well. So nice to talk to you again.
Really good to talk to you. So, Catherine, I thought we had learned our lesson in Florida. What happened?
I think we had. When I was in the Senate, I tried to pass election reform, and there wasn't the political will to do it. But then after being Secretary of State, and we came back, we said, we're going to pass election reform, all the media mocked us and said it would never happen. Well, we did pass my bill, plus everything else we learned, testified before Congress. They said it was the model for election reform, and it's been modified numerous times. So we have an extraordinary model for election reform, and we have laws that are sufficient to take us through this. A lot of this issue has been patience in the process. We do have a mandatory recount. We do have a manual recount if it's 0.25%. But, Glenn, this is Florida. And what I mean by that is not Florida, oh, my goodness, we're going to have these problems. We're not a red state. We're not a blue state. We're a purple state.
Right.
We're always going to have close elections, and it's not a constitutional crisis. The laws are going to get us through. We can legislate this clearly. We can't legislate integrity.
So here's the problem. The Brenda Snipes thing, from a distance, seems like she shouldn't have been there, you know, a long time ago she should have been fired.
Well, you know, the supervisors of elections, which many of your listeners may not realize, are constitutionally elected officers, meaning that each county elects them, and they are solely responsible for their equipment and solely responsible for the organization of the ballot. Now,
wow.
The Secretary of State can give input, but they have no authority over them. Hence, we had Teresa Moore in the butterfly ballot. Now we have Brenda Snipes. She can be removed, but only by not by the Secretary of State.
All right. So yesterday, they're supposed to have everything in by 3 o'clock this afternoon. And yesterday, was it Palm Beach or was it Broward that said, oh, our machines are overheating and now we have to do it all over again?
They are antiquated machines, and they are well aware that they needed to have proper equipment going into this. Many of the supervisors at elections office I talked with in Sarasota, they said, hey, this midterm is going to be a big deal, and we plan for a presidential election. So antiquated equipment. But what's interesting, and this is, I think, what's important, whenever I was Secretary of State, my only safe harbor was people got tired of me talking about I'm just following the law. Some of the laws I didn't like, but they were the laws we had at the time. And our rule of law is our bedrock of our nation.
Right.
It restricts all the arbitrary exercise or abuse of power by making it subordinate to existing laws that are well-established and well-defined. So that's the bedrock. Now, what frightens me was my personal experience. We went to the – and people never knew this or recalled it, but we petitioned the Florida Supreme Court immediately after when the recount was going to hit for a statewide recount. And they refused.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats were more interested in Al Gore's political viability and prolonging what is this first phase called the protest phase. And by doing so, they short-circuited the opportunity to recount statewide in the contest phase. So when courts interfere with the law, when politicians interfere, when lawyers interfere, there are unintended consequences. So here they thought they were being so clever. to enhance his political viability, but they short-circuited themselves. And this is what worries me with these exceptions. The Florida Supreme Court finally intervened and said, no, you don't do a statewide recount. You're just going to count them in these three heavily Democratic counties, mm-hmm. and that's going to determine the result for Palm Beach, mm-hmm. Broward, and Miami-Dade. In doing so, they ended up losing at the end of the day at the U.S. Supreme Court because it wasn't equal protection mm-hmm. under the law. But you probably remember Palm Beach came back and said, well, the Florida Supreme Court said you can certify Friday or Sunday, sort of an arbitrary mm-hmm. edict, but they said you shall. That's not maybe or sort of. So we said, while the nation is waiting and we need to get on with this, we're going to wait till Sunday to give everybody the time and the abundance of caution. So come Saturday, Palm Beach started saying, we're not going to be ready. You have to extend. And honestly, you know, I thought, I can be generous. I can extend. But had I extended, I would have broken the law.
So today at 3, is that where the judge said you have to have it done by 3?
And if for some reason someone thinks they're being generous to extend, it's just wrong. And I'll tell you why. You have to follow the law as it's written, and I'll make one other point about that. But Teresa LaPorce in Palm Beach said, oh, just 3 hours. Oh, just a day. They hadn't finished counting in 3 weeks, 3 months. They never finished counting. And I would have broken the law, and I would put everything asunder that I had sought to do in following the letter of the law. That is the only safe harbor. Mm. Now, as to not following the law, we have great election laws. If you don't like them, change them the next legislative cycle as we did in 2001. However, to come along now and say, absentee ballot signatures don't have to match the reference in the supervisor's
wow.
elections office, that is breaking the law. To say, oh, no, we want to count every vote, even all the illegals should even count, anyone who voted should count, that is breaking the law. In the last election cycle, felons were not allowed to vote. In the future, they will. In the last election cycle, they were not allowed to vote. If they allow the felons to go through, which there were 42,000 felons on our rolls in the secretary in election 2000, if they allow that vote to go through, that is breaking the law. Just because you don't like it does not mean you don't follow it.
Catherine,
you have to follow the law.
Thank you very much for reassuring America that it's not 2000 all over again and it's not out of control.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
The world is completely upside down, and when it gets to that point, it's always good to have Rabbi Daniel Lappin around. Rabbi Lappin is just one of the best guys. I mean, if you've never heard his podcast, you need to listen to his podcast. He'll explain why clothing needs to, not be unisex. And he takes you back through history, and he's fantastic. He's a fantastic teacher. He is with us now, Rabbi Lappin. How are you, sir?
Couldn't be better, Glenn. Thank you very much indeed. Only just slightly concerned. I appreciated your introduction very much indeed. It was far more than I deserve. But you did indicate that my prime usefulness is when the world is upside down.
Well, you are in great demand then, right now. the world has truly unhinged from reality all around the world. Nobody is paying attention to things that we should be paying attention to. China is becoming 1984, a police state beyond anyone, beyond George Orwell's imagining. They're now into this hemisphere. They are now bringing that technology to Venezuela. We have a woman in Pakistan who is a Christian who they're screaming to be beheaded, where the Supreme Court said this is a trumped up charge. There is nothing happening. The Pakistani Supreme Court And the UK is afraid to bring them in. Sharia law is now starting to be a part of the UK. Then you also just have the fun of the last election.
Well, in passing, let me just drop in one little thing, which may not be relevant to our discussion today. But when you said the whole world is going crazy, there seems to be an exception. Large parts of Africa are actually quite sane. And this is a fact. Ghana, Nigeria, Zambia, and many, many other places as well. What I mean by this is that I've recently been doing some speaking in both the United Kingdom and in Switzerland. I just got back from Switzerland last week. And in both cases, I have found that there are Christian evangelical churches packed to the rafters, and the leadership is almost always pastors from Africa. Mm. Now, this is really fascinating, of course, because in the 19th century, we watched England and Europe bringing the gospel to the so-called dark continent, to Africa. Well, Africa's returning the compliment right now. And it's really a pleasure to talk to many of these people who are completely free of the infection of secular fundamentalism, which drives so much of what you're describing in Europe, elsewhere, and even in the United States.
Because you believe, and we were talking about this the other day. Let me play an example of it. Here's a group of people that are out protesting a speech by Ben Shapiro, a bunch of college students. I want you to listen to this exchange and help me make sense of this.
Do you think you should speak tonight or no?
No, not at all.
What about free speech and the Constitution? How does it work?
That's a good point, but he shouldn't be allowed to have free speech if he's going to preach the kinds of things that he preaches.
Well, what are some of the things that you're talking about, though? I just mean what he said.
I don't know what he said specifically.
Okay. Do you know any quotes or anything?
I don't know what he said specifically. I just don't agree with his platform. I'm against Ben Shapiro because, I mean, it would take a while to describe everything that's wrong with him.
Protesting or for Ben?
Okay, stop. So, I mean,
perfectly normal, perfectly natural. This is exactly what would have happened had a Catholic priest stood up in 720 when the Muslims were sweeping through the Spanish peninsula. And he would have said, hey, I want to give a speech about why Catholicism works. What would the Muslims have done? They wouldn't have said, oh, that's an interesting thought. Why don't we have a symposium on the topic? They wouldn't. They'd have taken off his head.
Right.
And then they convert his church into a mosque and they move on to the next town. That's what you do. Look, this is about competing faith systems, literally competing religions. It is not different from when the Muslims stood at the gates of Vienna in 1683. And who was it? It was the king of Poland who actually saved the Western world on that day. It's not different from any time there have been clashes between competing and incompatible faiths. Ben Shapiro stands for, as do you, for heaven's sake, for so many years, Glenn, for a worldview based on a Judeo-Christian biblical model. And the mobs on the campus stand for a vision that is based on the Tower of Babel, essentially. I mean, 9 verses at the beginning of chapter 11 in Genesis provide a complete matrix of understanding of the tension that is taking place there. But, of course, they don't want to hear what he says. Why would they?
Tell me, go quickly go over the 9 verses, if you can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, there's not 100 different ways of organizing society. There are 5,000 different cultures in the world, but there are not 5,000 different civilizations in the world. Of the many lessons my dad taught me, one of them is he used to bring home mechanical clocks that were broken. To this day, I still don't know. Like, did he talk to people and say, "Hey, you got any clocks that are?" I don't know where he got these things from, but he used to bring them to me and suggest I try and repair them. And I mean, I still love fiddling with gear wheels and things. But there was a lesson at the end of the day. The lesson at the end of the day was there are not 20 different ways of reassembling that clock. There's only one. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there are lots and lots and lots of different civilizations all equally as good as one another is not one that merely I disagree with. But all those folks who drown in the Mediterranean struggling to get from Africa to Europe, well, they also agree with that view. And all the people who recognize that there's no illegal immigration problem in Kinshasa, and no illegal immigration problem in Saudi Arabia, and guess what? No one's struggling to break through the borders of Pakistan. I haven't noticed any caravans moving towards those borders. Everybody agrees that the civilization that was created by the West provides the ultimate in freedom from misery. It provides the ultimate in terms of medical achievement, scientific achievement, economic achievement. And there are not a lot of ways of making that happen.
So how do you, when you are dealing with a religion, which I think you're right, this is now religious fervor. You either believe it or they crucify you.
Yes.
They burn you at the stake. They will destroy you. I don't know how scientists even. And
that girl just lacked the words. I mean, what she was really trying to say was, I don't care what Ben says. He's a heretic.
Right.
That's all there is to it.
And I don't see how they don't realize they're not Galileo anymore. They're the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Look, what distinguishes a religion from a tennis club? And really only one thing, and that is that it answers three transcendent questions of life. Essentially, the most important one, how did life arrive on this planet? You know, here we are on this sort of remote speck of dust in a remote galaxy in a limitless universe. And although we've been searching avidly, spending vast amounts of your tax money and mine, trying to find other life in outer space, which is, you know, something that would be fantastic, because then it could prove that this really was a random occurrence. But at the moment, so far, we've only got life on this planet. You've got to answer the question of how we got there. And there are only two doctrines to explain that, and both are religious doctrines. Neither is provable. If they were, there wouldn't be any debate any longer. One is that a good and loving God created us in his image and placed us here. That's one view. The other view is by a lengthy process of unaided materialistic evolution, primitive protoplasm turned into plumbers and proctologists or whatever. I mean, but one shouldn't laugh at other people's belief systems because that's rude. But that's really what this is all about. And everything flows from how you answer those two, that basic question. Secular fundamentalism has become the official state religion in America. It's certainly the religion of the temple of American culture, the university campus, and that's why the battles are being fought over there on the campus.
So did you say you were over in England?
Yes, I was recently, yes.
This thing with Asia Bibi is very disturbing. Are you following that?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so this is the woman who has been in prison over in Pakistan for 9 years on trumped-up charges. She was supposed to be executed. The Supreme Court looked at her case over in Pakistan. They said this was a mistake, a travesty of justice. They released her. She's now under government protection, which you can't really trust that for very long. She's asked the UK for shelter and refugee status. They will not give it to her because they said she'd cause probably too many disruptions and civil unrest in the United Kingdom. As I'm looking at the United Kingdom, Rabbi Lappin, you've got the Labour Party being investigated for anti-Semitism. You have all of the police, it seems, and all of the government structures hiding from the bad element of the Islamists and hiding the bad element from others.
Yes.
How close are we to losing England?
Well, I thought very close indeed until I had a chance. I spoke for 22 churches in 21 days, and I had expected, I didn't fully understand. I thought I was being put in front of English Anglican churches. Mm-hmm. I wasn't. You walk into most Anglican churches in the United Kingdom, and there's three half-wits sitting in the pews because they've got nowhere else to be.
Correct.
But
so like going to church in New York, it's their art galleries now.
Oh,
or,
no, it's a,
you
it's
know,
a
bars.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I spoke for Hillsong Church in London, 10,000 people sitting there. Mm. And so it was in every church I spoke. So, look, I personally believe, being as this is a struggle between two competing belief systems, I do think that the only hope is not political but religious, because we know back till the year 2000, even the New York Times agreed that the most reliable correlation of Republican voters was regular church attendance. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that in the same way that we saw a huge religious reawakening in America fuel the War of Independence, and we saw a second religious mm-hmm. reawakening propel the abolition of slavery, I think we're looking forward. I'm looking forward. I mean, I don't want to sound like an Orthodox rabbi singing Onward Christian Soldiers, but but I'm looking forward to a third religious reawakening, because when people's hearts change, so do their politics.
So you and I have been friends for I don't even know how long now, and you're so friendly to the Christians, and I hope to be as friendly to Jews as you are to Christians. And we both know that Martin Luther King was right, and you got to change people's hearts. But how do you do that in a world where so much is justified? The pushback, people have had enough. They've had enough, and it's become insane. And if you don't push back, they're going to steamroll you. I think that's why Donald Trump won. He won because he was not afraid to have somebody say something bad about him, and he was going to fight fire with fire.
That's why I supported him. Yeah, absolutely. No question about it.
So how do we not lose our decency in that?
Look, Glenn, I don't want to sound insincere or flattering at all, but I'm talking the truth when I say that this is something you've been doing all along. You remember our get together in Utah, there've been so many of the get togethers.
Yes.
Bringing together like-minded people, I think, is the clue. I think it happens in evangelical churches in America. It happens in Orthodox synagogues. But it doesn't have to take place in a specifically religious environment, as Donald Trump showed, and as you've been doing for much longer. When people come together at the mall, you remember mm-hmm. that great event you put together, and I was so honored to be there. People happen to be people in general. If we would have said to those people, look, you may not have thought about this, but we're putting you on the spot. You absolutely have to tell us, which of these two arguments do you prefer? People were put here by created in God's image and put here by God, or people grew up out of primitive slime into chimpanzees and then people. You got to pick which one is closer. The overwhelming majority of people who were in Utah, who were at the mall or anywhere else that you gather large mm-hmm. crowds of people, would have said, well, we're on the side of God, creator. Can't prove it, don't know, but if you force me to make a decision, I'm on that side. That's what the majority of people would have said. On the university campus, the majority of people will say the other side. And one of my books, it's called America's Real War, which you did a great deal to popularize years ago, when we spoke about it on one of the shows, that I'm reissuing that book with new chapters, because here's the big missing piece. You got to explain the strange and bizarre alliance between radical Islam mm-hmm. and American liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
What are these two groups got to do with what? Well, the answer is everything.
Yeah.
And that's crucial to understand.
Rabbi Lapin, always good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.